Columbia's highest court is about to make a landmark decision on the future of abortion. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Some abortions are allowed in Colombia, but only under limited circumstances. What will this week's decision mean for women's reproductive rights across Latin America? Also, we're just 4 weeks from Florida's primary, and we're just finding out that the elections office in Palm Beach County was attacked by ransomware in 2016. We'll hear from the reporter that broke the story. Finally, Anna and the Tropics is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play coming to Key West. It's the story of Cuban immigrants working in a cigar factory in Ybor City, Florida. But this version doesn't take place in Tampa. This production highlights the Cuban cigar-rolling community of Key West. We'll meet one of the actors of the show. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The Florida primaries are less than a month away, and if you want to vote in the primaries, today is the last day to register. You can find details online at WLRN.org. County elections offices across the state of Florida are collecting mail-in ballots and building a volunteer staff for primary day. Palm Beach County is under sharp scrutiny after the problems that it faced in the 2018 midterms. And it was recently uncovered by the Palm Beach Post the county's elections office was targeted in a ransomware attack in the weeks before the 2016 election. We're now joined by the Palm Beach Post, Hannah Morse. Hannah, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The Post broke the news of the ransomware attack through an editorial interview with the current supervisor of elections, Supervisor Wendy Link. How did they discover what happened? How did this finally come out?
Right. So when Supervisor Link was interviewing the second in command within the elections office's IT department, she was speaking with him about his credentials and if he would be able to step up to the IT head position. And that's when she learned that there was this ransomware attack a couple weeks before the 2016 general election.
Now, they had their former IT director, Jeffrey Darter, was arrested in November of last year. Remind us of what happened to him.
Right. So Jeff Darter, a longtime IT director within the Supervisor of Elections office, he was arrested for child porn possession charges.
When he was in his position, though, did he know anything? Did he say anything? Do we have any idea if he knew of a ransomware attack?
I haven't spoken to him personally, but there are current employees at the elections office who are aware of the situation and say that he knew about this attack.
So a lot of the details of the attack still remain unclear. Do we know who exactly was targeted and what these hackers wanted?
Right. Like you said, we don't know the exact target of this attack, but we do know that this was a virus called Zepto, which is a ransomware virus, and it encrypted some typical office files like Microsoft Word or Excel spreadsheets, and some of those were lost.
Was voter information or the county's election tabulation machines at risk?
All indications for those who were there or not there, like Supervisor Link, everyone says that no voter information was impacted in this attack.
And once the breach occurred, was the state or federal authorities made aware, considering, again, the proximity to the November election? So did anybody tell anybody?
It appears that neither the state nor federal authorities were alerted to this.
Was money paid out? Because when we talk about ransomware, a lot of the times it's, again, it's a virus that's put into a computer system and a group of hackers perhaps or a hacker is asking for a ransom. Was there a ransom paid?
No. They were able to contain the spread of it and nip it in the bud, and no ransom was paid.
So it was uncovered from the Mueller report that two Florida counties were targeted by Russian operatives during the 2016 presidential campaign. The report didn't specify which counties. Do we have any sense if Palm Beach County is suspected to be one of them, though? What does Supervisor Link say about that?
So Supervisor Link says again and again that she has no information about that. So she believes that Palm Beach County was not part of that ransomware attack.
I'm talking with the Palm Beach Post reporter Hannah Morse. In 2016, the Palm Beach County's elections office was targeted by a ransomware attack. Now, what did they get? Again, a lot of information we don't know yet. You could read the full story right now. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. So, Hannah, there's another wrinkle in this story. Former supervisor of elections from Palm Beach County, Susan Booker, is arguing that the ransomware attack never happened. What did she say?
Right. So at first she told the South Florida Sun Sentinel that the office was, quote, never ransomwared. And she did speak with the Palm Beach Post editorial board, reiterating that nothing happened. She said, quote, it was a simple thing that happened, saying that somebody clicked on an email that triggered a virus and it went from there. But nothing was paid. Nothing was impacted.
Booker was replaced by Governor Ron DeSantis. Why?
So she was replaced after the November 2018 elections for delaying recounts in three statewide races.
And remind us again of what happened during the 2018 midterm elections and why Palm Beach County, along with Broward County, were in the news a lot because of the recounts and how long it was taking.
Right. So there was some hiccups with the recounts, and it took until December 26th to get those results from Palm Beach County. And so Governor DeSantis took it upon himself to suspend Susan Booker, and then she later resigned.
Do we know if the machines in you know, at the supervisor's office have been replaced, the counting machines? Have they been updated before this upcoming election?
So I recently took a tour of the Supervisor of Elections office in Palm Beach County, and Supervisor Link said she replaced everything from the tabulation machines, the scanners, everything to be up to date with whatever everyone else is doing throughout the state of Florida.
The 2016 attack raised a lot of questions about the security of Palm Beach County election system as a whole. Our reporter, Danny Rivero, also spoke with Supervisor Link back in January before this attack was made public, and he asked her about the issue of cybersecurity. This is what happened.
If somebody hacked into the Pentagon, I can't tell you that they're not going to hack into someplace in Florida. It could be Palm Beach County. But from my standpoint, did we do all the research? Have we done absolutely everything we could have done heading into this so that we're as ready as we can be? And that's where we're holding ourselves accountable. Are we properly trained? And that, so we're doing that. And the core service, we want to provide excellent service to the voters. So I think we're focused on those three things.
So is the answer yes, that you feel like you've done all that you can do to protect against anything like that?
We will have. we're in that process. And I don't mean to be coy with that answer, but I can tell you we have some things in place that are lined up to be completed before the March election.
So, Hannah, I mean, coming back to what Supervisor Link has said about cybersecurity, I mean, your take on what you heard there, is that any different from anything you've heard the supervisor say to you?
No, that's also what she told me. And she said because of the 2016 attack, she was able to get preferential treatment from the Department of Homeland Security. There was a team of six or seven people at the office over a period of 10 days, kind of combing over everything to make sure they're doing everything possible to make sure that the elections are as secure as possible.
What have you heard from your readers in response to this story?
So most of our readers are just surprised that they didn't know about this when it happened, and they're wondering why no one knew about it in the first place.
I wondered if you'd heard anybody ask questions as to, you know, how do I know? I wanted to get a sense if anybody's lost faith in the system before this upcoming primary.
I think there are always going to be people who are questioning it, and rightfully so. They want to make sure their vote counts and isn't changed at all. And it sounds like supervisor of elections office across the state of Florida are taking that into account, especially with such an important election coming up.
Are the FBI and other law enforcement still investigating the ransomware attack?
Supervisor Link sent a printout of the code from the 2016 attack to the FBI, and it sounds like the Department of Homeland Security is also taking a look into this to see how this happened, who was it, and what were they looking for.
You know, as we have the primary coming up again in less than a month, is the state going to be helping out? You know, is the federal government in any way going to be involved? Again, is the confidence there that Supervisor Link has fixed the problem from before, has resolved any issues, and that because of this ransomware attack, that they have secured the system before the election?
So everything that Supervisor Link has told me, she says she's doing everything she can to make sure that there's no breach. But she says no breaches aren't impossible. As she said, like the Pentagon can be breached, so can the Palm Beach County Supervisor elections. But she has indicated that there are measures being taken, people being brought in to make sure everything goes smoothly in March, in August, and November.
Have you had, do you get the sense that you've had easy access to the supervisor, to anybody there at the office? You said that you got a tour of the facility. You know, do you get the sense that they've opened things up to allow the news media to come in and be able to watch the process? And, you know, especially during the primary, we're going to be able to see everything to make sure that we don't run into any problems.
That is my assumption of it. I didn't cover Susan Booker before she left office, so I don't have that to base my opinion on it. But it does appear that she wants to, Supervisor Link wants the public to know that their elections are as secure as possible.
We've been talking with the Palm Beach Post, Hannah Morse. Again, you could read her story by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Again, learned recently that the Supervisor of Elections Office in Palm Beach County had been attacked by ransomware in the weeks before the 2016 election. Again, still an investigation ongoing. Don't know what kind of information they were able to get, but we'll keep following this story. Hannah, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Well, just a reminder, today is the final day to register to vote in Florida if you want to vote in the primaries. We have details online, again, at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Columbia's highest court was going to make a decision on the future of female reproductive rights. And again, it could be a major shift for all of Latin America. More on that coming up. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The country of Colombia was set to issue a ruling this week on abortion that could have ripple effects throughout Latin America. The country's constitutional court is going to decide to either put an outright ban on abortion or establish a similar system to Roe v. Wade here in the United States. Now, currently, abortion is allowed in Colombia under specific circumstances in the cases of rape, if the mother's life is in danger, or if the fetus is malformed. WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett joins me now to talk about this. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lewis.
This was supposed to come down this week, but breaking news, it's my understanding you've learned that the ruling may be delayed. Why?
Yeah, because one of the nine justices on Colombia's Corte Constitucional, its constitutional court, which is its high court, its supreme court, one of the justices apparently has taken sick, and a ruling that was supposed to come as early as tomorrow then may be delayed for maybe a matter of weeks.
You reported on abortion laws in different Latin American countries. How would you describe the attitudes, how attitudes have changed or maybe stayed the same on this issue throughout Latin America?
I think stayed the same is the better way to put it. Latin America has some of the most draconian anti-abortion laws in the world. No other region in the world has as many countries as Latin America does that ban abortion outright. even in cases, as you were just talking about, of rape, when the mother's life is at risk, things of that nature. Six countries in Latin America have those outright bans, and most other countries do not allow the kind of abortion legality that we do in the United States. They only have systems like Colombia presently has, where you allow for those severe exceptions.
It was, what, 14 years ago, right?
14 years ago, Colombia decided. Colombia was like those other countries that I just mentioned before. It banned all abortions outright until 2006, when it allowed for those three exceptions that you just mentioned. And there are only two small countries in Latin America right now, Uruguay and Cuba, that allow the kind of Roe v. Wade legalization of abortion that we have here in the United States. And then one city, Mexico City, does.
So this decision either is going to ban it outright, or it's going to give us Roe v. Wade sort of situation where up to there abortions will be legalized up to 12 weeks.
In the first trimester, right. Just as Roe v. Wade, laid out back in 1973.
How did we get to this point? Why is Colombia here at this decision now?
Because I think since they passed those, since the court ruled in 2006 that to allow those exceptions for legal abortions, what you've seen is that even women whose pregnancies fall under those conditions have found themselves facing obstacles after obstacles to getting the abortions that essentially are their legal right. And so that has led a lot of pro-abortion rights groups in Colombia to pressure both the legislature in Colombia and the judicial system to liberalize even further abortion legality in Colombia, so that women aren't facing those kinds of obstacles. What that has done then has prodded the anti-abortion activists in Colombia to come to the court and say, now, wait a minute, we don't even agree with the three conditions you put. We should take Colombia back to before 2006 and ban abortion outright again. And so that's where we are. That's where the Constitutional Court in Colombia then is weighing those two options, whether to take Colombia back to the way it was before 2006 or to push Colombia, push that ruling from 2006 even further, so that we, as you said, are legalizing abortion, all abortions, in the first trimester of pregnancy.
Tell us a little bit about the court and how it's set up and who's on it.
Well, it's nine justices, as I said, and it's not as conservative a court as many others in Latin America. And what's ironic, I guess many people would say ironic, is that you look at the court makeup right now. Four justices are believed to be firmly in favor of legalizing abortion, all abortions in the first trimester, and all four of those justices are men. The three justices who are opposed to it are two men and one woman, and then the swing votes on this issue, it turns out, are two female justices. There are three female justices in total on the court, and two of them are going to be the swing votes on this issue.
And one of them is not available this
week.
Not
available. Sick, as we've heard. And
but do you get a sense of which way they might be leaning?
The two swing votes. If you talk to abortion rights activists, they feel that those two women probably, well, let's put it this way. They're pretty sure that they would not allow the abortion situation in Colombia to go back to before 2006. Whether or not those two women justices would go for a further legalization of abortion, that's the big question.
Who are the organizations, or what are the organizations, I should say, that are leading the fight for reproductive rights in Colombia?
Well, there are a few. The two most important seem to be, one, Pro Familia, which is sort of the equivalent of Planned Parenthood in Colombia, and it has been on the forefront of this issue. There's another one called La Mesa para la Vida y Salud de Mujeres. The translation would be Table for the health and life of women. It's like Pro Familia. It's a reproductive rights organization, and both have been very strong advocates for legalizing abortion in the first trimester in Colombia, and then again, you have to remember that. And this is a point I try to make in our piece this week, that Colombia really is in sort of a moment right now that America was, the United States was, in 1973. In 1973, you didn't have an overwhelming majority. In fact, you did not have a majority of Americans telling pollsters that they supported legalization of all abortions in the first trimester. It came down to a majority in the Supreme Court here that made that the law of the land in Roe v. Wade. Colombia is sort of in the same situation. I think most Colombians agree with those three exceptions for legal abortion that we pointed out that were mandated in 2006. It's a much bigger question whether most Colombians favor legalizing abortion the way we have it in the United States. In fact, the last reliable poll on this, which was done in 2014, showed three-fourths of Colombians opposed it.
How much influence does the Colombian diaspora have on this issue? Or, I mean, does it even matter?
I think it's the other way around. I think it's what kind of influence the ruling in Colombia will have on the diaspora here, not just Colombians, but all Hispanics. One of the people we interviewed for our report this week, he educates Hispanics on. He's an anti-abortion activist who heads up education on abortion for Hispanics. And groups like his, for example, are very much hoping that the Colombian High Court will rule to go back to before 2006, because they feel that that would have an emotional effect on Hispanics here. They would look back at Colombia, look back at Latin America, and see that the continent is still very rigidly pro-life. And they hope that maybe that will keep Hispanics here in the U.S. from continuing this trend that we're seeing in polls that shows Hispanics favoring abortion rights increasingly.
I'm talking with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett. Again, Colombia's Constitutional Court was set to rule this week on a landmark abortion case, but there is a delay. Now, you can hear Tim's Latin American report about this story today at 4:44 p.m. or just go online, WLRN.org. What are the agencies that perform abortions in Colombia? Is it like the Planned Parenthood you
right.
see here?
Right, Pro Familia is one of them. And I should mention that, you know, one of the things that has made this ruling even more dramatic in Colombia is just in the recent weeks, we've had a case that both sides point to as evidence that their side is right in this. There was a woman from a town called Popayan, Colombia, and she had an unwanted pregnancy. It was making her so distraught that doctors diagnosed her as suicidal. So under these three conditions, she was legally, she had a legal right to an abortion. But she kept getting blocked when she would go to clinics, when she would go to healthcare officials. And so by the time a judge finally granted her an abortion, she was 7 months pregnant. She had it. She had it with the help of this group that we mentioned, Pro Familia, and it erupted into a national controversy, obviously, because any abortion at 7 months of a pregnancy is going to cause controversy. But the pro-abortion rights side points out, look, this would never have happened if she had simply been able to have her abortion in the first trimester when she requested it and not run up against all these obstacles. The other side of the issue, of course, claims, no, this case is just an example of how Colombia has become too lenient, too liberal on abortion.
Because of all of the roadblocks that a woman might face, what do we know about the safety, when it comes to getting an abortion safely or maybe going somewhere and it's not so safe?
Well, I mean, what the pro-abortion rights forces in Colombia claim is that despite the fact that these women have a legal right to these abortions under these three conditions, because they always face barriers, the majority of these women simply end up having to go find illicit, back alley style abortions that can be very dangerous. And they say that's one of the reasons that Colombia needs to further legalize abortion. I think there are some statistics out there that show an overwhelming majority of women who otherwise would have a legal right to abortion under current law in Colombia today still have to go out and seek illicit ones.
And as I mentioned before, again, your story airs again today. If you didn't hear it this morning, it airs again this afternoon at 4:44. Part of that story you're going to hear a woman that you spoke with in Colombia about her experience. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Diana Alarcón was a teenager in Cali, Colombia, when she says she had to seek a clandestine back alley abortion. I had to knock on an enormous wooden door. Someone opened a peephole and I had to give a password. I couldn't afford local anesthesia, so I fainted during the procedure.
There's a lawsuit that was filed by the doctor of constitutional law, Natalia Bernalgano. I hope I'm saying that right. Last
year.
Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church supports this. Mm-hmm. What is this suit about?
Well, she is the leader of the anti-abortion activist forces who are pressing the Constitutional Court to take to reverse, essentially, their 2006 ruling and not allow any abortions at all. And her claim is that, A, she feels that that 2006 ruling was unconstitutional because it essentially takes away the rights, the constitutional rights of the unborn. That's her claim. But the other interesting claim she makes is that allowing any kind of abortion for women in Colombia is actually detrimental to their health, particularly their mental health. She says, she argues that she has studies that show that any kind of abortion leaves a woman with post-traumatic stress, as she calls it, grave mental post-traumatic trauma. And that's, you know, we can argue about whether she's, you know, presenting sound science or not, but that's one of the arguments that the court is looking at right now, according to her lawsuit.
Do you see the same thing in Latin America that you'll see here? In the United States, obviously, there are states with much tougher restrictions for women to get an abortion, so women could just cross the state,
right,
go somewhere else. Do you see that in Latin America, where in some countries they're going to cross borders to go to a country where they can?
Well, the problem is most, as we pointed out before, hardly any countries in Latin America allow for abortions, any kind of abortion in the first trimester, unless it falls under those three conditions. So if you're a woman with a pregnancy, an unwanted pregnancy, but your pregnancy doesn't fall under the category of sexual violence or fetal malformation or threat to the mother's life, you're just simply going to cross the border into another country that's just like the country you just left. So there really are no alternatives for women in that regard.
If Colombia goes towards a Roe v. Wade sort of situation, how big is that for Latin America?
It would be very big because, as I pointed out before, the only places in Latin America where you do have legal abortion in the first trimester are small countries, Uruguay, Cuba, and Mexico City, as I pointed out. For a country as large as Colombia to put a Roe v. Wade-style abortion system in place would have a really big impact on other countries, particularly other larger countries like Argentina, which 2 years ago almost, its Congress almost passed legal abortion.
But do you see if Colombia goes that route, that other countries will then start to pass similar laws?
I think, because not only is Colombia large, as I point out, it's also a very culturally influential country in Latin America. It tends to be a bellwether in many ways. And I think that if that country were to adopt a Roe v. Wade style system, I think you would see more impetus than in places like Argentina, even Brazil next door. And that then, I think, would begin to have an effect on the smaller countries that have the most severe anti-abortion laws, like El Salvador, which you have sort of a witch hunt situation in that country, where any woman, for example, who has a miscarriage tends to get accused of having tried to induce an abortion. And, you know, you have many, many women behind bars in El Salvador and other countries in Latin America where abortion is banned outright because of that.
What's the influence of the Catholic Church right now in Latin America, and how has that been changing?
Well, the influence of the Catholic Church has been waning on a lot of issues, but not this one. And even in countries where you see more liberal governments, they tend to just concede to the Catholic Church on this issue because they see it as one way of just sort of placating the Catholic Church so that they can pursue liberal projects in other areas that they perhaps deem more important. And so the Catholic Church does still exercise, particularly in places like El Salvador, but also in Colombia, a very strong influence.
Look, I mean, this is an issue that is obviously hotly debated in this country.
Sure.
And both sides can get really, really nasty with each other. Do you see the same thing in Latin America? I mean, because I've seen anti-abortion and pro-life and pro-choice groups, And I mean, you know, besides the types of visuals that they'll bring to, you know, their marches, sometimes the sort of threats and activities they'll do kind of cross a line in some cases. Do you see that in Latin America?
You don't see that to the degree that you do here in Latin America. You don't, I don't think you hear all the sort of the baby killer kind of shouting from the anti-abortion forces in Latin America that you hear. And I don't think you hear a lot of the women killer, you know, kind of rhetoric from the pro-abortion rights forces in Latin America. I think that's because it has been the status quo for so long that abortion was illegal, that abortion was criminalized. So I think you're coming from a different sort of emotional starting point in Latin America than you are in the United States.
And how does the media in Colombia cover this? How do they cover this kind of issue?
Well, I think it's new for them. I think what's happening in Colombia has sort of startled the media. I've been reading interviews in the Colombian dailies with the leaders of both sides of this issue, and you can tell that they're kind of, you know, grappling, struggling to find their own answers for what's going on because they're not used to having to cover this controversy as repeatedly as we in the media here in the United States do.
The decision was supposed to come down Thursday, but it's delayed. Is it just a matter of when the judge?
We're waiting for this one justice, I guess, to recover from his or her illness, and then we'll see debate renewed in the court, and then perhaps a ruling at the end of this month or early March, we're hearing.
We've been, again, talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Check out his story this afternoon at 4:44, or you can go to WLRN.org. The issue, the debate about abortion in Colombia, and if you are from Colombia or a Colombian or anywhere in Latin America, actually, Latin America, tell us your thoughts on this. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis.
Still to come, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play about Cuban cigar makers is coming to a theater in Key West. Coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, starting in the late 19th century, waves of Cuban immigrants came to Key West seeking political freedom and jobs in the island's growing cigar industry. Key West held the title at the time as the cigar-making capital of the world. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play Anna in the Tropics tells this story. It was originally written about the cigar rollers out of Ybor City in Tampa near the turn of the 20th century. But a new adaptation of the show moves the setting from Tampa to Key West. Nayem Cardenas Lopez plays the role of Marela. She's joining us now from the studios of Key West. Nayem, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So for people who have never seen the show, how would you describe it?
My favorite way to describe it, firstly, the writing is so poetically braided in terms of the relationships. So that's like the top layer for me, but you're really getting to see the familial sort of roots in cigar making, the Cuban history, just all the love that went into, you know, the seemingly simple thing that's just a cigar that you smoke when you need to relax. It really has such a beautiful history, and you get to dive into this one specific family's sort of life in that time, in that setting.
And, you know, one of the interesting things, too, about this story of the cigar rollers is, you know, you have to picture, you know, a sort of warehouse type of setting, and you have a lot of people working on these cigars. And there's one person who is sitting usually at the front of the room or, you know, somewhere in the middle. And this is a person who is reading the daily news or reading stories, mm-hmm. kind of sort of an entertainment, I guess, for all of the cigar workers, right?
Yeah, and more so an educator for people who a lot of the times couldn't read, couldn't write, but they would learn these stories, they would know profound poetry, and get to know more about the world around them outside of their life in the factory.
So you play the character of Marella. Mm-hmm. Tell me, who is Marella?
Marella is the youngest of the family, so it's her and her older sister and her parents, and also a step-uncle, sort of. And she is a very lively, hopeful, whimsical young person, but also has a profound knowledge for her age, sort of a peaceful wisdom about herself that I think she has gained by being the youngest one, by being the one that the family always sees as little, maybe underestimates. So she surprises you, I think.
When you read her character, you knew you wanted to play this part. What is it about it? What resonated with you as an actress?
Well, so I'm also the youngest of my family, and Marella is a year younger than me. So it just felt really natural. And I was drawn to her because I thought that I could bring a lot of honesty to the story as it was my own, in a way. Also, just allowing myself to become that whimsical again, that childlike, that hopeful.
Again, I'm talking with Nayem Cardenas Lopez. She plays the role of Marella in Anna in the Tropics. The play runs until February 29th in Key West. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN.org. And as I mentioned, one of the interesting things about this version of the play, the original version, took place in Ybor City, which is out by Tampa, but this version takes place in Key West, which of course is being played in Key West. All right, I know we were having a little technical issue there. We did hear you, even though it was a little bit off, but I think we may have fixed it. But I wanted to ask you, Nayem, about the play starts with the arrival of a character by the name of Juan Julian. Who is he, and why is he important?
Oh, well, he is the catalyst of everything that happens in this play. But he is the lector, the educator, as I said before, the storyteller, the entertainment of the factory workers as they're working this fast-paced lifestyle, this fast-paced process. And he comes in and sort of unintentionally jumbles everything up. In our personal life, that's all I will say about that.
And how does Marella react to him?
Oh, well, she is just smitten. She, it really feeds into her dreaming ways of, you know, fantasizing and hoping and, you know, that sort of thing. And then in comes this educated, attractive person, and then, you know, her mind just goes.
There is a scene from the play that I was hoping that you might give us a little bit of a taste of. Would you do that for us?
Absolutely.
All right, just lead us into this part. What's happening before you tell us about, or before you perform it for us? Tell us a little bit about, set it up for us.
All right, so I have a moment alone with said lector, Juan Julian, and it's after the celebration of the launch of our new cigar. And everyone's left, and I have a moment to sort of express my joy and my longing for the night to go on forever. And that's it.
All right,
it.
Here we go. Go ahead.
All right. I don't want the night to end. I could stay up all night. I don't want to sleep. We sleep too much. We spend more than a third of our lives sleeping. Sleeping. Darkness descends and everything is a mystery to us. We don't know if trees really walk at night, as I've heard in legends. We don't know if statues and spirits dance in the square unbeknown to us. And how would we ever know if we sleep? We sleep and sleep.
Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. Your character also, Marella, values family and unity. How does that play out throughout the show?
That's a great question. She
You know, I think first and foremost in her life, her family are her best friends. You really see her relationship with her sister throughout, even if there's no language, there's just an unspoken bond, even though she is the older sister, even though they might have a little fights here and there as sisters do. You really see how much she loves her sister and her parents. Like, I think that Marela really idolizes her parents individually and together as a couple. And I think that they are why she has become so whimsical, because she has gotten to feel this joy in her life of the unity of her family. And I think that she has allowed that to let her dream and enjoy the joys of life and really be open to the possibilities of the world, because it wasn't shut down in her.
So one of the fascinating aspects of this show is one of the changes that the director made was, instead of taking place in Ybor City, it takes place in Key West. Mm-hmm. You're not from Key West.
No, I'm not.
You're from up north.
I'm originally from Texas. I live in Brooklyn, New York now.
Okay. So two very different places from Key West. Is this the first time that you've been in Key West?
No, I actually was here to do a show at the studios last year, an original by a local multifaceted artist, Michael Marrero. That one was placed in Florida as well. But I was a Middle Eastern girl in Florida, growing up in Florida, and Dennis was in town. And had already had Anna in the Tropics in mind and had me in mind and had somebody come see the show and hired me from there.
Tell me about your first impression when you, the first time, last visit you had. What was that first impression of Key West like for you?
Well, nobody told me about the roosters.
Okay.
So I came out of the airport and my friend Juliet Gray was here to pick me up, and I was like, did you see that? And she's like, yeah. I was so stunned by the roosters. But overall, like, I feel like the Key West has just got such a cool mixture of, backgrounds, like mixture of places. Like, it kind of reminds me of Hawaii, but, you know, very Latino, like Hispanic. I can see the roots here. It also has like a pastel vibe as you're going through the city. There's a different pace here. Absolutely. There's kindness everywhere, a certain breath to everybody and everything here that, especially coming from New York, is wildly lacking there.
And no roosters in New York that I remember ever seeing. What's your background? Where are you from? Because you're from Texas, but what's your background?
Yeah, so my mom is from Mexico, and my biological father is Saudi Arabian, so I'm half and half.
I wonder with, as an actress, how you bring your personal experience into this story. This is the story of Cuban immigrants, the Cuban immigrant experience. It's like any immigrant story. Just unique in the sense that, there's such a deep history of it in Key West.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you learning some of that history and how that helped you in preparing to play Marela?
Well, just entirely eye-opening for me because, I'm young and I think I know everything sometimes. So, I know so much about the Latin culture and I think that I'm educated in it. And then I come here and I'm doing this play and I'm learning so much about the other facets of Latin culture, beyond Mexico, beyond Spain. Learning about the Cuban history is so rich and also very humbling to know that, it is a massive part of what built the economy down here, what built the start of a lot of Florida. And it's very, very cool to know that that was brought from Cuba here. It's sharing. It's what makes this country so beautiful.
And again, a part of the adaptation really highlighting this immigrant, the Cuban immigrant experience. How do you see that playing out? Everything that you just described to me, how do you see that playing out throughout this production?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I mean, think about, again, you know, what you've learned of the Cuban history in Key West. Tell me a little bit about how, in this adaptation, you guys made sure to bring that out in you know, for this play.
Mm. Well, you know, what I think is interesting is that sort of with the fire that happened in Key West that shut down a lot of the cigar rolling here happened right around the time that Ybor was picking up. So for me, it's almost like, you know, what it would have looked like if it continued booming the way that it was here. You know, this story feels like it could have been placed perfectly in Key West. It's like what could have been, although it did continue, of course, but it took quite a dive. I think that, you know, a lot of the culture is comparable both in Key West as it is in Ybor, you know, the Cuban culture, the weather. So I think it's almost too easy to place it here.
Yeah. But what's it like, by the way, the majority of the performers are Latinx, right?
Yes.
What's that like? I mean, because it does add some authenticity, but what's it like, you know, when you're working with mostly a group who are?
Well, there is, I mean, just a familial bond that happens almost immediately. A playfulness, you know, a joy, a jokingness that we all grew up with. So it just like immediately clicked when we got together, which is so cool. I've never been in a play with this many Latinx actors. So it's been really fun and exciting for me. And, you know, it feels like we've known each other for so long.
And they're from Key West, right?
Yes, everyone is a local here, except for me.
You're the outsider. Well, how does that play, you know, in that dichotomy between all of y'all?
You know, I didn't even think about it because I felt like we immediately got together. It wasn't until recently that I was like, oh, wow, I am the outsider. Like, I realized it. I don't know. They took me in. I mean, of course, I'm a little rougher on the edges because I'm from New York. So I had to soften myself up when I got here. I was like, oh, right, everyone's cool down here.
Well, just a little more relaxed. I think a very different attitude, I think, than in New York. What's it like performing here compared to performing in New York?
Oh, yeah. I mean, worlds. You know, there's a speed in New York. There's a sort of go, go, go in New York that makes things sort of time has to bend toward the style of New York, whereas here you have a little more space. You have time to let things grow, you know, space to walk away, come back to it, to think on it, to cook. So I think that allows for an ease and a more of a sort of gently diving into and allowing a natural growth in the process here versus in New York, where it's like you just got to go and you got to make it happen.
And what about the audiences, though? Audiences in New York, what's the difference in what they expect to see compared to what you've learned from Key West and South Florida audiences?
Well, I think both of my shows have been placed in Florida. So I the very first one, people were like very excited to get to see a show about the place that they're in. You know, it feels a lot more connected to them, personal, and they're so warm. Whereas, like, sometimes in New York, people can be a little hard to please.
So real quickly, you know, for anybody who's never seen the show, they're going to go watch it. What would you tell them about, again, how to approach this story?
Mm. Well, I mean, we are welcoming you into our family, I think. You know, I wouldn't even think about, you know, approaching it. Just, you know, put yourself there. You are with us. You are part of the factory. You know, enjoy the time that you get to be with us in our story. Like, you are, everybody who comes and sees a show is one of us. And, yeah, if you want to learn a little bit about the culture, the history, too, that will make it that much more rich and exciting to watch.
Nayam Cardenas Lopez performs in the production of Anna in the Tropics. It's in Key West. She plays Marella. The play runs until February 29th. You can find more information about the show on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Nayam, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and break a leg.
Thank you so much. Happy to have been here.
And that's Sundaw for this Tuesday, February 18th. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, coronavirus cases in China continue to rise. The latest estimates are that more than 70,000 have been infected. The development of antiviral medications is happening in facilities across the U.S., including right here in South Florida. We're going to hear from a lead researcher at the Scripps Research Facility in Jupiter, Florida, about the fight against the coronavirus. Plus, teen dating violence has always been a problem, but new dating apps have given it different forms. A new study out of Florida Atlantic University surveyed thousands of middle schoolers and high schoolers across the U.S. We'll speak with the lead researcher behind that study. Don't forget, by the way, we do have a book club. Are you reading our book? We are reading Craig Pittman's Cattail for the month of February. You can always join the book club, see a video of our conversation with Craig that we had at Books and Books. And, of course, we'd always love to hear your thoughts on the book and what you're reading right now. Find us on Facebook. Again, just look up Sundial Book Club. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. We'll be right back.